in the U.S., unfortunately, you've got basically zero compulsory education on finance. You know, you can get all the way through college and not have been required to take a single finance class. So people are not taught about how money works. You know, I didn't even really realize how fiat currency worked until I got into Bitcoin. And then I was just like, holy crap, this is a total scam. You know, people don't know. You still ask someone today, why do they believe that the dollar has value? And they'll say, well, it's backed by gold. And, you know, that just hasn't been true for a long time. So, you know, people just, they have no understanding of how money works, how investments work, how to evaluate an investment, how to financially plan for your future. It's just like ridiculous that people can get all the way through college and not have any understanding about these things. You have to wonder if that's intentional, if there's somebody in power that maybe controls the financial system that likes that people don't understand how it works, because maybe if they knew how it worked, there'd be a bit more of an uprising. Or, you know, the opportunities to take advantage of these people that don't know what they're doing would not be so great.
Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there, how is everyone? I hope you're all having a great week. Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast, where you get to hear from the best minds in Bitcoin and crypto. I'm your host, Peter McCormack, and this week I've got an interview with the super cool CEO of Kraken, Jesse Powell. But before that, I have a message from my show sponsors. Okay, so firstly, let's talk about Deribit. I'm pretty excited to have these guys on board as a sponsor, as I've heard a lot about them recently. When I was at World CryptoCon in Vegas, I was chatting to some of the traders, and it appears that a few of them have been moving over to Deribit for their trading. So why are they creating such a buzz? Well, firstly, they've never been hacked. They've built a platform for stability, so they've got no system overload crashes like you see on other trading platforms when the prices go crazy, and they can easily support high frequency trading. They also support instant withdrawals, and they have never once had a socialized loss, so that's pretty cool, right? So if you want to check them out, head over to deribit.com, which is deribit.com, and you can get a 10% discount for your first 6 months. Okay, so next up, let's talk about BlockFi. These are my regular sponsor. They've been sponsoring the show for quite some time now, so a big thanks to them. So did you know you can take out a loan backed by your cryptocurrency? Whether you're looking to finance a business or buy a house or even pay off your student loan, BlockFi helps investors use their Bitcoin, Ether, and Litecoin without selling it. Backed by Mike Novogratz, BlockFi is the leading crypto to USD lender in the US, servicing over 45 states with interest rates as low as 7.9%. And they have a special offer for the listeners of my podcast. If you sign up at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, you can get $25 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans under $10,000, or $50 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans over $10,000. And applying takes less than 2 minutes. So you want to check those guys out? Again, head over to blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid. So onto my interview with Jesse, and I need to tell you about how this one came about, because it's kind of a funny story. Some of you will know that I have a Patreon page to help support the show, and a few weeks ago I had someone take out one of my sponsor tiers, a Jesse Powell. I hadn't connected the name, and when I asked him which project he was working on, he humbly said Kraken, and then I was like, ah, right, you're Jesse Powell, the CEO of Kraken, the master troll of New York. He didn't want to take out the sponsorship. He just wanted to support the podcast, which is obviously very cool. That's just the kind of guy he is. Many of you will have seen the donation that Kraken made to Coin Center. He's just one of those people. So I reached out to him and said, look, can you come on the show? He was more than willing to come on. So that was great. Yeah, really cool to have him on. We get into lots of interesting stuff in the podcast, the challenges of growing an exchange from 0 to 800 employees, the fear of being hacked. And we also cover some wider industry issues such as poor performance of mainstream crypto journalism and what happened at Mt. Gox. I think you'll enjoy this interview. I really enjoyed doing it myself. If you want to support the show, like Jesse, you can become a patron. But just head over to my website, www.whatbitcoindid.com. There's a support section there that will tell you everything you can do to support the show. Okay, so onto the interview. I hope you enjoy it. If you do have any questions, you know you can reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com, and I look forward to hearing from you. Hi, Jesse. How are you?
Hey, doing well, thanks. How are you?
I'm pretty good, thank you. Can I explain how this interview came about, the steps that came in?
Sure.
So go for it. You're a patron of mine.
I am.
Which is obviously very, very cool. But embarrassingly, when it came through, I hadn't made the link. So obviously you made your regular donation, of which were my highest. And then when I spoke to you and I was like, oh, what project are you on? You said, oh, my project's Kraken. And I was like, oh, you're there, Jesse Powell. And then I was kind of a bit embarrassed. So thank you for doing that.
That's all right. Could have also been the R&B singer. Jesse Powell.
I didn't know there was an R&B singer. So this is really cool. It's very cool to have you on. I'm obviously aware of Kraken. Obviously very successful, been going a long time. It would be very cool to understand and hear how you've gone from a Bitcoin enthusiast to running one of the world's largest exchanges with over 800 people, and how you make sense of it yourself and what kind of perspective you have on it all.
Yeah, so it's been a long road. We got started in 2011, so it was very early days. Back then there were very few people even interested in crypto. I remember going to the first Bitcoin conference in New York in August of 2011, and there were like less than 100 people there, and a bunch of familiar faces that you still know today. Tony Gallippi, Roger Ver, Gavin Andreessen, basically guys that all went on to sort to be prominent figures in the community. It was a tighter knit community back then. You know, now it's kind of gotten out of control, where you have the mainstream coming in, all kinds of scammers coming in. You know, people aren't just in it for the technological innovation anymore, or for changing the world. You know, there are many people just in it for profits, which I think is totally fine too. You know, it's but it changes the culture. And so as far as getting the company from zero to 800, you know, first, like I said, there are very few people interested in this space, and so we kind of hired wherever we could. So we weren't just committed to only hiring people in San Francisco, you know, which would have been left the pool very small. So we hired pretty much wherever we could find people remotely, and we continued to do that basically throughout the last 7 years. Being a remote first company, the vast majority of our employees are remote, and it was kind of a gradual pace of growth. There were a couple hiccups along the way. You know, 2014 was pretty rough. Going into 2015 was pretty rough. You know, there was a time where the company was like 30 people, and we had to lay off half the company just to survive. You know, so we got up to like 30, and then back down to 15. And kind of like grew gradually from there. Say like the end of 2015, we became profitable. We started to grow gradually. And then it was really like the second half of last year where things just really started to pick up. And, you know, we basically like tripled the size of the company in a quarter, you know, just trying to hire to keep up with the breakneck pace of growth. And then ended up having to do some layoffs again earlier this year, basically to take it back down to a level that was more appropriate to the current demand. There are all kinds of crazy things that happened all along the way there, as you might imagine, you know, in 7 years of crypto.
I can imagine the managing staffing levels is sometimes as volatile as the market, right? Because if you're growing quickly, you've got to recruit quickly. But if there's a sharp drop and you suddenly don't have to service as many clients, or possibly you don't have the revenues that you'd had from the previous year, you don't have the luxury of the staff. So you kind of have more of a transient staffing kind of policy.
Yeah, and it's not something that as a financial services company that you really want to have. You know, I mean, we prefer to have people that are going to be with us for the long run, that we can invest a lot in training, that, you know, we have more time to vet, you know, to make sure that they're not, you know, criminals just trying to get a job on the inside to facilitate a crime. So having to hire very quickly is a dangerous thing. A lot of just managing that process securely is building out the infrastructure and the controls internally to make sure that if you do have to hire someone quickly, then at least they don't have access to do a bunch of stuff that they shouldn't be able to do. So there's also like a lot of work that goes into the back end that people just don't see. You know, the users are of course like obsessed with their user experience, with the interface, but there's tons of work that has to go into the back end as a financial services company just to make sure that things aren't kind of being destroyed from the inside. you know, that your funds are still going to be secure, that people aren't stealing your information, that we're following the requirements of the regulators, you know, that we're meeting the requirements of our banking partners, keeping the funds secure. So there's just, it's kind of like an iceberg, really. There's all this stuff that goes into the back end that is never seen by the user. And then, you know, you have the tip of the whole project, which is just like the website that people see and interface with. So it's
right.
Is a lot to keep up with.
What's the culture like of the business, and how do you maintain that culture with such a large distributed team?
Yeah. So since we've done this from the beginning as a remote company, and the majority of people are remote, you know, we're fortunate that the tools for having a remote company have really developed quite a lot, just in the last 7 years. You know, like Slack didn't exist 7 years ago. Things like Signal, Keybase, you know, didn't exist. So the tools for doing remote work are improving. You know, G Suite's improving. Just the collaboration tools are really getting a lot better. And so it makes it a lot easier to have a totally remote team. You know, so being able to basically hire from all over the world gives us a larger pool of candidates to choose from, and therefore we can be pickier about the candidates that we take. You know, we're not just stuck with whoever's in the pool in San Francisco. We can take from anywhere. And so we can raise the bar a bit by doing that. You know, we have some things in the interview process that I think help us keep the quality level high. From we try to develop a test for every role, so that we're not just kind of hiring the person who's the best at selling themselves. They've also got to like take some form of test to prove that they actually have the skills or the ability to think about certain kinds of problems, you know, that they're really going to be able to perform in the function that they're applying for. We also have people that interview for culture fit. For some teams, we have this ideological purity test, which is sort of a test of whether you're kind of aligned with the vision of Bitcoin and crypto. And I think that's important for some teams. You know, a lot of the guys that we have on the team came to the company because they're just like hardcore crypto nuts, and they appreciate what Kraken stands for. They want to do something that is going to continue to further the space. In many cases, they could be independently wealthy. You know, maybe they bought Bitcoin in 2011 and they're retired, but they want to continue to work on something that is going to push the space forward. So, you know, we're really lucky to have a lot of guys like that basically work because they're on a mission. And I think that really helps like keep the culture strong and, you know, on mission, really, which is, you know, for us, it's not just about making money, which is nice, but we didn't start this company to make PayPal 2.0. You know, we don't want to be in the same spot another 10 years from now where the regulators have taken over. It's gotten so insane that basically all the advantages of crypto are gone. And, you know, we're just like a PayPal that does Bitcoin.
Is that why it's important for you then personally to take a stand sometimes and stand up against things? You know, you've obviously been vocal on a couple of points, and we'll talk about that shortly. But also not just that, but the donation you make to Coin Center, does that kind of crystallize the vision of what Kraken stands for itself?
Yeah, so the donation to Coin Center, well, we had a great year last year, so that was helpful. But you know, I think as the space grows, Coin Center is going to become even more important. They're basically the EFF of crypto. You know, they are not defending any particular interests of any particular businesses. You know, they're basically defending the protocol, the consumers. You know, what is in the interest of the development of this technology broadly. And so they're interfacing with regulators and law enforcement on behalf of the entire ecosystem. So Coin Center is interfacing with regulators and law enforcement on behalf of the entire industry, trying to kind of put the brakes on any unnecessarily burdensome regulation, making sure that they really understand what the issues are, and that things are being done kind of in a fair way that allows the ecosystem to grow. So they're doing everyone a huge service. You know, for us, it benefits us. It benefits the whole ecosystem just to have these guys kind of in the way and also appearing as an independent kind of neutral party to this. That's not, you know, they're not working for Kraken. They're not out there pitching all the benefits of a centralized exchange or anything like that. They're just there to say, hey, like, let's let this thing grow. Let's like hold off on the crazy regulations. You know, we'll take a risk-based approach. They're educating politicians and law enforcement. And I think they've really done a lot to keep things alive, you know, to keep things from being crushed too early. And I still think that that's a possibility that, you know, you could get the UN together at any point, could just say, okay, Bitcoin's illegal. If you're found with Bitcoin, it's going to be confiscated or you're going to prison or whatever. There's still like crazy things that could happen. You know, we haven't gotten there yet, but I think every day is just about buying a little bit more time, you know, for it to get a little bit bigger, to eventually get to the point where it's unstoppable. And I don't think that we're at the point of being unstoppable yet. So I think organizations like that, you know, even the internet is not unstoppable yet. You constantly see these aggressions against the internet and people trying to control the internet one way or another. So I think it's just going to be a never-ending battle. And to have somebody like Coin Center constantly being, you know, kind of the champion of what's actually good for the consumer is really key.
Was your donation match the second part?
Yeah. So we offered, we donated 1 million and we said we would donate an additional 1 million matching. And yeah, it was actually oversubscribed. So we actually ended up raising more than 3 million in total for them last year.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And so having grown a company to 800 people, you've obviously gone through various stages of raising funding. You know, I think I saw on Crunchbase there were four rounds, 11, 12, 14, and 16. I'm not sure if Crunchbase is always that accurate, but you didn't raise last year, which probably would have been the easiest year. You missed the easy one. So what's it been like raising funding at those different points?
Yeah, we actually only raised twice. Once was in the end of 2013. And then again, in early 2016. And that was really just like an insider round. We took some more money basically from existing investors and a few other strategic investors. Getting money, venture capital in 2013, and actually we were trying before 2013, and we didn't actually close that, I think, until December of 2014, or sorry, January of 2014. It was really hard. There were basically no VCs that understood the space. And it was this challenge of having to explain to them what crypto is. And then if you could get them to that, I mean, you just imagine how much time that takes somebody to wrap their head around, like, okay, so there's this thing called Bitcoin, and why should I care about that? And then and why isn't this going to get shut down, you know, in 2 weeks by the government? And you know, so many hurdles to get your mind around why Bitcoin's a good investment. And then on top of that, you have to buy this thesis that, okay, if there's this exchange and this exchange somehow is going to manage to not get hacked, not get shut down by regulators, be a competitor against other major financial institutions. So it's just a super hard sell. And we eventually ended up, you know, we basically talked to like everyone in Silicon Valley. And it was just way too early. You know, it kind of shattered my image of what a venture capitalist is supposed to be, which, you know, until then, I kind of thought that there's these guys that really are very visionary and forward-thinking, and they take risks on things. And it turned out like that was not actually the case. I mean, they understood a few businesses really well, but things that were kind of outside of that box were just hard for them to understand, and there are actually very few VCs that are willing to write the first check. You know, there are many people that will follow. Will say, you know, okay, you have Andreessen, who's agreed to invest well, we'll just like throw more money after anything that Andreessen invests in, you know, so that's like easy to come by and that's not very valuable. So it's like getting the first check that's really hard. But eventually we had, we got our first check from a firm called Hummingbird Ventures, which is actually based out of Belgium. The partner that we were working with there is Pamir Galembi, and he's got a new fund now called Libertas. But he was all over crypto from early on, and so we were just really lucky to find Pamir and Hummingbird. And after we got the check from them, we were able to get on. We didn't really get on other VCs. We got on. So Barry Silbert came in before there was DCG. We also had an investment from Blockchain Capital. You know, so there were a few investors that were really focused on the space, but and the rest was just like crypto angels, basically, like guys that bought some crypto early, liked what we were doing, and were willing to invest in it. And back then it was it's always kind of a hard sell getting crypto people that already understand the merits of crypto to trade in their crypto for fiat and like give you some fiat. You always have to ask the question, like, is this going to outperform Bitcoin?
Yeah.
So, it was really awesome of those guys to come in. And I think actually we have outperformed Bitcoin, which is awesome. So yeah. I'm happy those guys actually have gotten a good comparable return on their investment.
That's pretty cool.
But yeah, I think it's still tough for people to raise money. Last year would have been the perfect time to do it, or earlier this year. Fortunately, we've been in a spot that we don't need to raise money. I think if we did another round at this point, it would be purely for like acquisition purposes. Like maybe acquiring more companies while the market's down or something like that. But the company's been profitable since 2015. The last quarter, not so great. Not comparable really to Q1 of this year, which was totally crazy. But we're still doing very well, and I think the space is just going to continue to grow. So much upside for everyone in the space right now. So hopefully, I think people will not need to go to VC so much in the future. I think we'll continue to see crowdfunding working. I do have some concerns about, obviously there were tons of scams that came out. And I hope that people take more care with what they're investing in. With any kind of early stage project, there's always like massive risks, and I think that people have seen some of these crypto projects like Bitcoin just go from like 1 cent to like $20,000 and think, well, that could happen with any token. But, the reality is like so much can go wrong along the way that, I think some people kind of imagine like this like best case scenario kind of like for some tokens, like, okay, if they're going to do this and if they manage to do that for the whole world, that market is worth, like $1 trillion a year, and they conceivably could take over that whole market. And so the token conceivably could be worth $1 trillion. So if I buy in now on day one at $100 billion valuation, I've still got, like a 10x of upside here.
Yeah.
When, the reality is like, you have to really price in the risk of execution, or like anything could happen, in the 10 years or 20 years it takes to go from nothing to actually something that is dominating a market.
But it's quite a inexperienced market, the retail market for token trading. I found the market became flooded last year with people who just kind of jumped on the bandwagon. They didn't really know what they were doing. And I don't think anyone had figured out really, there's a lot of hindsight attacks and criticisms on ICOs, but I think at the time, not everyone understood what was happening with them. And now it's only that people have lost money, they're starting to reflect and say, look, is there any intrinsic value in these things at all?
Yeah, I mean, the market's pretty much down by like 90%. I think that some things might be more appropriately priced at this point. But I think some things, you know, by venture capital standards are still vastly overpriced. And a lot of the projects have had the incentives screwed up. You know, the founders have already taken their exit. They've already found liquidity. They're sitting on $20 million or whatever. The incentive to really work hard for the next 10 years and make something of that project are very low. You know, they've kind of got to really feel like a moral obligation to do it at this point, you know, but it's certainly not going to be for their own financial interest because they're pretty much set already. I think investors always need to be worried about the incentives of the operators.
Yeah.
You know, and when you cash out your operators on day one, how incentivized are they going to be to keep running it for you?
But like you said, you know, and it's almost like we needed this wave, this kind of crazy wave to bring the interest. And I do think another wave will come personally, but I think it'll be very different. I don't think it'll be as crazy as we had. And I think I've been looking at some kind of projects. I'm quite interested in some of the work that Bruce Fenton's doing, looking at bringing a little more structure to investing in securities within crypto. And I think it will come, and I think it will happen. But I also, conversely, I'm not really sure if too much liquidity is a good thing for these projects. I think sometimes too much liquidity could drive the value down because people want to exit too quickly. You know, I know a lot of venture guys complain that it's very hard to exit a project, but, you know, usually when they do, it's at a decent valuation. I'm kind of split on that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, personally, I think from having run a few companies, it's a distraction to have your stock be publicly traded. You know, where you have, I mean, just thinking about the number of people in the company who are like obsessed with the price of Bitcoin, you know, on a day-to-day basis. Just imagine having to deal with that for your company's stock, and having every employee be obsessed with like, what is the value of their stock today, and what can they do to maybe like optimize the value of their stock around some sort of like personal exit situation versus just focusing on the long-term growth of the company, you know? So I don't think that having liquidity early on is really, you know, I think it can be harmful, and it's nice to have people locked up for a while and kind of forced to like actually build something and have something to show for it at the end of like 4 years or 6 years or 10 years. You know, I think more of these projects, if they had just kind of committed to that sort of lockup, like, hey, okay, we're going to raise some money and the founders are not going to get to sell anything for 10 years and we'll see where we're at in 10 years. And if we're more valuable in 10 years, great, then we'll get to cash out. If not, then sorry, we worked for 10 years for nothing. You know, I think that would be more aligned with the investors' interests. But I think that there are some cases where having a company's stock be widely distributed can be really valuable. Like when you're trying to like grow a network, you know, if you're like a Facebook and you want to incentivize a bunch of people to start using your platform, and you're really dependent on this getting some critical mass for this network effect to be valuable, then in those cases, I think giving away stock would be really great. And then you have the incentives of the platform very much aligned with the incentives of the users, which is not the case that you have now with Facebook, right? Where you have like the shareholders' interests are actually at odds with the users' interests, you know, after some point, right? Where it seems like the users are stuck there. So now we can just start milking them for everything. And, you know, can start selling their data. We'll just do whatever we think we can get away with, without losing a critical mass of users. Whereas I think if you had all of the Facebook users as shareholders, I think you would see the business actually operating more in line with the interests of the users. You know, you wouldn't have the users themselves voting to sell all their data away to marketing companies.
Yeah.
So there's definitely like some value that the users have, like on their own privacy, that isn't respected by the company. The shareholders are willing to sacrifice that. So I hope that we're able to see more of that kind of thing. It's problematic to do that right now because of the way securities laws work. But that I think is a good use case for security tokens. More so than like just getting liquidity for the employees of the operator.
Yeah. So one of the things I would imagine running a exchange is a constant fear of the giant hack. And I know you haven't been hacked to date, and you probably have some of the best, most strict policies in place. But is it something you get over eventually, or is it something that's always sits with you?
I don't think it should be something that you get over. It's something that still sits with me for sure. I feel as time goes on, just better and better about our infrastructure. You know, we're just building more robust systems, better monitoring, better reconciliation systems, like all of this stuff too. Assuming that we're going to get hacked at some point to just deal with the consequences of it or mitigate it to the greatest extent possible. But the risk is always there, and there's just new vulnerabilities emerging all the time as well, like Spectre stuff and these like supply chain attacks and things. You get more worried about, I think, operational security and like the security of your personnel. And as the reward goes up, for a hack, I think the hackers are willing to invest more in the attack as well. So you could imagine just some crazy like Mission Impossible style attack, hackers are like buying the building across the street from you and like putting telescopes, in the building to try to like see into your office to like track keyboard strokes or whatever. There's just like crazy things that people could do if they felt like the reward was high enough. Just like you watch these like heist movies where guys are like breaking into bank vaults and like tunneling underground and like doing all this crazy stuff, right? Fortunately, like the way that crypto works, we can have keys all over the world and you can't just like tunnel into one vault and get all the coins, but you can certainly kidnap a bunch of people and hold them hostage, right? And that's like a lot easier to do than it is to get the keys. And so the security of our people is something that we're focusing more and more on. You can look at Jameson Lopp's stuff all about this, about how to like basically like delete yourself from the grid. But you just like make one little trip up somewhere and you get entered into some database, and then suddenly you're everywhere. You have to start all over. So it's a really hard thing to do. The scary thing is you just see things on the news of like some guy like walks into a bank and like holds up the whole bank and shoots 10 people because like for like $50,000 of cash. You just get the right like idiot to think, oh, if I break into this crypto office or this crypto guy's house, maybe I can get $50,000 in cash or whatever, And even though it's totally not possible, he just needs to like imagine that it's possible and try to do it. So, OPSEC's really important. We're just constantly paranoid.
Is there any part of it, like, obviously I don't want you to reveal any of your secrets, but is there any kind of part of it that you can give me some kind of, I don't know, lens into the kind of the complexity and the depths of the operations? Without giving anything away.
Without saying too much. I mean, we do a lot of stuff. There's a lot of stuff happening behind the scenes that you would just never know about, which is why it makes it so hard to really like assess the security of other platforms as well, because you just don't know, like it's like this iceberg that could be doing, the sky's the limit with what you can spend on security. But some of the things that we're doing, we keep keys on different continents, we use multi-sig for everything. There are strict controls internally on what people can do and logging for for basically like every action someone would take internally. We have automated triggers for things, for people doing suspicious things internally. There's a lot of monitoring, really, that goes on. And as far as like personnel goes, the key people in the company try to keep as low profile as possible. I unfortunately have to be the public face of the company, but like if you look on LinkedIn, you probably see the company only has like 200 people or something like that. And that's because we tell people like, look, if you don't have a need to be publicly associated with the company, just don't do it, because it's painting a target on your back. You could be hacked, and then the company could be hacked because of that, or you could be, the scary thing is like people, the SIM porting is still going on. People still having their phones hacked, or their wife's phone hacked, and the phone companies, at least in the States, seem not able to control that. We would recommend people use Google Fi because that seems like the most secure so far. You get your phone hacked, and then someone gets into your email, and maybe they find something compromising in your email, like, oh, you're cheating on your wife, and now they can blackmail you, right? Like, they don't have to hack Kraken. They can just blackmail you to operate from the inside for them. So, like, monitoring for stuff that might indicate that someone has been compromised somehow, like they're looking at an account in the admin console that like for which there's no support ticket, or for which this like user actually hasn't like contacted us, like something like that would be suspect and looked into. So really it's like, yeah, a lot about monitoring and just about trying to keep people off of public like social media platforms and stuff advertising that they're affiliated with Kraken or even affiliated with crypto. Because these guys are like scraping LinkedIn and Twitter looking for anyone mentioning Bitcoin, and then they'll target them.
Next up, I talked to Jesse about crypto regulations and problems with mainstream crypto journalism. But before that, I have a message from my show sponsors. Okay, so let's talk about Deribit again, the platform for Bitcoin traders. As I mentioned, I'm really excited to be working with them, especially with all the great things I've heard about them from some of my trader buddies. So again, why are the traders moving to their platform? Well, they've never been hacked. They've built a platform for stability so it doesn't crash through big price moves, and they can easily support high frequency trading. They also support instant withdrawals and have never once had a socialized loss. Right now, they are a Bitcoin-only futures platform offering up to 100x leverage for you crazy leverage traders, perpetual contracts with 100x leverage too, and they have the only liquid Bitcoin options market in the world. So go and check them out. Let me know what you think. Head over to deribit.com, which is deribit.com, and you can get a 10% discount for the first 6 months. Just a note, Deribit is not available for US citizens. And next up, let's talk about BlockFi. If you need to get a payment, but you don't want to sell off your crypto, BlockFi can help you. BlockFi is the leading crypto to USD lender in the US, servicing over 45 states. Use your crypto to do things like buy a car, pay off your credit cards, or even pay your taxes. There's no need to buy tokens or pay a membership fee to get started. Just visit blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid to learn more about using your crypto without selling. And they do have a special offer for the listeners of my podcast. Sign up at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid. You can get $25 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans under $10,000, or $50 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans over $10,000. And applying takes less than 2 minutes. Is there like any internal working groups? Like, do the exchanges talk to each other? Do you share ideas, or are you completely isolated and work completely independent from each other?
No, many, probably most of the exchanges do work together. We share information about security vulnerabilities, about hacked accounts, to the extent possible. Usually law enforcement requests are prohibit us from discussing them, but to the extent we can, we share information about threats and account compromises, like tracking stolen coins that move from one exchange to the other. That's like probably the most common thing that we interact about, is coins moving from one exchange to the other and trying to freeze those coins before they get out.
And how much of your experience with Mt. Gox influenced how you structured and set up Kraken. I didn't even know about your involvement with Mt. Gox, by the way.
Yeah, well, it's been going on for quite a while, since 2014, basically. So, and before 2014, you know, it was sort of the inspiration for starting the exchange in the first place. I first got involved with Mt. Gox in June of 2011, when they got hacked for the first time. And that experience led me to believe that really we needed more exchanges in the ecosystem and people doing it the right way. And so when we started Kraken, we knew from the beginning that exchanges are going to be targets. People are just going to try to hack us constantly. And we really have to do things right from the start. You know, we have to put security above everything else, because just one hack could blow up the whole business. You know, everything you spent years working for could be gone in a second. So so we really invested in security heavily from the beginning, making it our top priority. And you know, that was largely driven by just seeing Mt. Gox get hacked, and then just along the way, you know, have that be reinforced many times by, you know, exchange hacks, or just, it seems like, you know, at least once a quarter there's some major hack happening. So it just keeps reinforcing the need to have really, really strict security, and to invest a lot in it. And, you know, unfortunately, it's one of those things, you just don't know the value of it until you get hacked. But it's like, you know, every day that you don't get hacked is a good day. So we just keep investing in it, and it keeps paying off so far, fingers crossed.
Are you able to monitor attacks? I mean, can you see that you're constantly under a barrage of attacks?
Yeah, there are always always things happening, like people run bots, so like fuzz websites and just look for known vulnerabilities, or look for like outdated versions of software that you might be running that have some kind of a, you know, maybe there was like a 0 day, or there's some known security vulnerability, and they're checking to see if you ever actually patched that. So that kind of stuff is happening all the time. It's rare that you catch something that's really specifically targeted. You know, cases, something that happened in the past would be like somebody figures out what data center you're at and then tries to like show up at the data center and like with a fake ID and like socially engineer their way to your cage. You know, that actually hasn't physically happened, but that would be like an example of something where you'd have someone red-handed. But there have been cases where they've called our data center and tried to impersonate us, and you know, tried to get the person at the data center to do things for them. You know, fortunately, they were smart enough to not let that happen. But you know, it's like a scary thought. I mean, and then you have to move data centers after that point, right? I mean, you definitely don't want people knowing where you're at. So it's a hassle. But there haven't really been anything where we've caught people like red-handed, you know, like really in a compromising position, or where they've gotten like really far, you know, like no one has like infiltrated our office or anything like that.
It's pretty impressive for 5 years, right?
Fortunately.
Because like almost yeah, every exchange has had one kind of hack or another. So you must be pretty proud of that.
Yeah, fortunately. Yeah, I am. You know, it's always a scary thing though. You know, like we have to assume you're going to get hacked at some point, and you just do your best to make sure that the damage can't be that bad when it happens.
Yeah. What do you make of what's happening with Mt. Gox? I mean, I had a strange incident. So I went out to, and we'll talk about conferences as well. I went out to World CryptoCon, not because I wanted to go to the conference because it was terrible, but I went out to meet up with Lynn Albrecht because she was presenting there. And while I was there, I was invited to an event regarding Mt. Gox. There was a new lead counsel. They were bringing a case against the Mt. Gox trustees because of all the fort coins that weren't dealt with. And it's just some other nonsense.
Yeah.
And it was held in a hotel suite with a DJ, booth babes with Bitcoin signs, and like a bar, and everyone was dancing. And like, I think the lead counsel was in like a Metallica t-shirt or something. And I was standing there thinking, what is going on here? And then in walks Brock Pierce, who I was told who's now bought Mt. Gox or something, like he's bought the show. And anyway, and I was just like,
yeah,
what is going on here? This is weird. So, but what do you make of everything that's going on with it right now?
Right now, the story just keeps getting weirder and weirder as time goes on. But it's now in this creditor rehabilitation process, which will basically allow everyone to get back their pro rata share of the balances. Whereas if the bankruptcy process had continued, the majority of the funds would have gone back to the Mt. Gox shareholders because of the way that the value of the coins was determined, like at the time it entered bankruptcy.
Because they were going to be paid in dollars rather than receive their Bitcoin.
Right. So everyone was going to get back their coin at $400 a coin, basically, you know, which was like the price when it went into bankruptcy. So, and then anything over that was profit to the business, basically, which would be taken by the shareholders. So this is the only way, creditor rehabilitation is the only way for people to actually like get their coins back out and not have like all this money go to the shareholders. So that's underway right now. Hopefully that'll be resolved sometime in the next few months. And we've actually been talking to the trustee about this problem, actually, of like helping them claim some of these forked or airdropped coins, which is several million dollars worth of coins, you know, given that they're sitting on like 200,000 Bitcoin.
Right. What was your involvement with it? Like, how did you originally get involved?
Yeah, so I was trading on Mt. Gox back in 2011, early 2011. So when they got hacked for the first time back in June of 2011, an old friend of mine from the Magic the Gathering days in high school, Roger Veer, happened to live down the street from Mt. Gox. And he went over there to find out what was going on. He was also, we got into Bitcoin right around the same time, early 2011. And found out that there were like two guys in the whole company and they needed some help. So called me up. I went out to Tokyo to help them out for about 2 weeks. And so that's how I got involved like the first time. And then when they got hacked for everything in 2014 and had to finally shut down permanently, we volunteered to basically assist the trustee in the bankruptcy process with doing the investigation, helping them manage the coins, helping them answer questions for people, helping them collect the claims, and then ultimately helping them distribute the payments back to people. And so that whole thing has been going on since 2014. So it's just taken forever in part because of some lawsuits, that are still open. Like this CoinLab lawsuit, this guy, Peter Vicenis has this like $75 million lawsuit outstanding. Basically it's been holding up the payments. But now that we're going back into creditor rehabilitation, like that won't have to be addressed.
Was he part of the Bitcoin Foundation?
Yeah, he was one of the founders of the Bitcoin Foundation.
Yeah, I thought so. Okay, so listen, the one thing I've obviously got to talk to you about is New York, the BitLicense, Ben Lorsky, now of Ripple, Ben Lorsky's BitLicense.
Yeah.
So I've never read the BitLicense documentation. I think you might even say, obviously, I did even try and take a look. I got about 3 pages in of the 44 pages, and I was just like, what is this? So you just rejected it immediately, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, we were part of the process of trying to get it to a reasonable state before it actually got rolled out. You know, there were like 3,000 something comments, public comments, and I think you could still see them on the New York DFS's website. About this, and we were engaged with the DFS, and we tried to get it to something reasonable, but you know, I don't know what was going through Lossky's head. You know, it seemed like he wanted to make a political statement, wanted to get himself in the spotlight for something. And what he came out with was a total disaster. I mean, it was the cost of putting everything together for the application was tremendous, you know, for the time. Now, you know, we could, of course, afford to do it today, but back then it was like, you know, money that we didn't really have to do it. It was like, it was going to be like $100,000 to do this application. And that was probably like, you know, half the money we had in the bank at the time or something. So that was absurd, but also just the amount of time it would take to produce all the documentation for things. And,
how much time to ongoing to ensure you're complying constantly?
Oh, right. Yeah. Huge amount of overhead there. And and some of the things that you know, basically it regulates your entire global business. It's not just the New York activity. You have to answer for everything you're doing globally and produce documents for everything globally and client information globally. And you can set up a New York entity specific to servicing New York and, you know, kind of carve everything out and have that in its own like isolated system. But there's also a lot of overhead involved in doing that. So for us, it just didn't make sense. And, you know, also as a statement, just a principle, you know, we were opposed to the huge overreach of it, you know, not just about the implications for our business as an exchange, but broadly, you know, like, it was like regulating miners and all kinds of like crazy stuff. Like you can't like trade CryptoKitties because you need a bit license in New York. So it's just like, it just went way too far, you know, and we had hoped that by sitting out, you know, that would send a message. And, you know, I wish that more companies had taken that position. And we might've been able to kind of negotiate for something more reasonable. But you know, there it is. And our last interaction with the New York DFS was that they're not at all considering making any changes. They're really committed to enforcing that. You know, we heard that they may be willing to work with companies on, you know, maybe not in enforcing the contract entirely as it's written, but having some room to take companies on a case-by-case basis and kind of evaluate, you know, some sort of customized approach. But, you know, that also is, I mean, that's not how things should work, right? I mean, it shouldn't be like you come to us and then you have this one-off thing. It should kind of be like, okay, you know what you're getting into going in, and everyone is held to the same standard. But when you have this rule that is way too crazy, way too strict, and then people have to come in on a case-by-case basis and then you're making exceptions, well, then it's not really the law, you know, it's kind of like driven by politics and how well you can suck up to these guys to like get what you want. But then who knows what happens when the guys running it switch up, you know, you've got a changing of the guard at the DFS, and now the new guy is like, well, I wasn't part of that discussion that you had 3 years ago. Now I'm actually going to enforce this particular piece of it, you know, so that's scary. So just all around a bad thing. You know, I hope that New York comes around at some point. But I know they see themselves as kind of the regulator of the world. It's unfortunate. And I think the people of New York have missed out.
There's a few big companies in New York, right? And I don't see the Winklevoss twins being the type of people to they're not rebels like you to go and stand up against them. So certain people are going to comply, and they're going to probably sit at dinner with the right people, and just because they're probably the kind of person they are. Like, I expect Jesse, like, I don't know you, but I expect growing up, right, I doubt you were the walk down the straight line kind of guy, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, I was a good kid, but you know, I think I have like somehow I have a, I don't know what got this into me, but I have like a problem with bullies, and I have a problem with people abusing their power. you know, and this is like what I saw coming out of New York. And, you know, we saw it with Losky. He walked out and walked into a consulting business, consulting on how to get your bit license. And then eventually in Ripple. I mean, it's so ridiculous, yeah, right? I mean, that should just, there should be a rule. Like if you put out some law and then you go into consulting about it after, then your law just is invalidated.
Yeah, I can't really take him seriously. Did you write the tweet from Kraken yourself, the one trolling the New York State AG? I've got it here. This is when they came with the accusations that people were still accessing New York, right? And you,
yeah.
Thanks to the New York taxpayer for funding this research. Saved our product a lot of time. We've got some interesting non-public info on our competition. Excellent overview of issues and a nice list of questions customers should ask. Did you write that?
I did write that. and I do think that they came up with a good list of questions that people should ask.
Sure, but it was masterful trolling.
Appreciate that. I don't appreciate the way that they went about asking the questions. It wasn't really presented in kind of a collaborative way. It was kind of like, hey, we're New York, fuck you, give us all your shit, you know, kind of, that was their attitude. I think if they want to protect their consumers, like, that's one thing, you know, there's a reasonable way to go about it, without having to piss off a bunch of people.
I find it's kind of hard. It's one of the hard things for me to get my head around from being from the UK, but is this state and federal laws. It just feels like it's, you know, somewhere like Wyoming, where you've got someone like Caitlin Long, who seems to be kind of pushing the envelope, and they've kind of been really open-minded. Yeah. And then New York's kind of closed-minded. And even like, but this is even on a kind of state level. You know, Malta is so open to crypto business, and it's just people are just filtering all the companies to who's the most open-minded. It just doesn't make any sense for what, fear of what, like money laundering and terrorists and. Come on.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, at the federal level, the national government is concerned with money laundering. It's the states really that are concerned about consumer protection. And that's why you have these like varying laws. You know, some states just believe that you ought to look out for yourself and you make your own decisions and you live with those decisions. Some states feel like they got to protect everybody from everything, you know, and then you end up with this like super nanny situation where you got to ask permission before, you know, you brush your teeth, because who knows, you know, you might poke your eye out. It might be dangerous.
I imagine you're more on the libertarian, make your own mistakes and learn from it side of things, right?
Yeah, I'm definitely leaning that way. But I think that there is a sweet spot. You know, I think that in the US, unfortunately, you've got basically zero compulsory education on finance. You know, you can get all the way through college and not have been required to take a single finance class. So, you know, people are not taught about how money works. You know, I didn't even really realize how fiat currency worked until I got into Bitcoin. And then I was just like, holy crap, this is a total scam. You know, I thought Bitcoin was great for other reasons, but, and then I learned all about fiat currency, and then, you know, I thought it was even better. But, you know, people don't know. You still ask someone today, you know, why do they believe that the dollar has value? And they'll say, well, it's backed by gold. And, you know, that's hasn't been true for a long time. So, you know, people just, they have no understanding of, how money works, how investments work, how to evaluate an investment, how to financially plan for your future. It's just like ridiculous that people can get all the way through college and not have any understanding about these things. And you know, you have to wonder if that's intentional. If there's somebody in power that maybe controls the financial system that likes that people don't understand how it works, because maybe if they knew how it worked, there'd be a bit more of an uprising about it, or you know, the opportunities to take advantage of these people that don't know what they're doing would not be so great. You know, big banks can charge all these crazy fees because people just don't have any clue about what they're doing. You know, it's like it's a black box to them.
Well, I'm just finding out 20 years after I left school that the 2 years I spent learning about John Maynard Keynes was all it's all now bullshit according to Safety the Moose.
It's a waste of time.
And everything I'm reading is kind of like, okay, so I had a state education that was teaching me the government rules on monetary policy are smart, and really it's just it isn't. So what do you make of the work the SEC is doing and their approach to regulation? Because it seems to me like from where I see, it's like, I don't like rules, but you kind of know it's going to come with the government, and it feels like they're taking a very, like, it's almost like a hands-off approach, and now they're just kind of step by step looking for the obvious kind of scams or problems where they see their consumer protection is needed.
Yeah, I mean, I got to give the SEC some credit on actually understanding the space and taking a light touch approach so far. I think that they've made some statements, or at least some commissioners have independently made some statements that are confusing. Like everything I've seen looks like a security kind of stuff. When clearly, like, that's not the case. So far they seem to be focusing on the obvious scams, you know, just like outright frauds that are not really specific to like tokenized securities. It's just like somebody tokenized a scam and they're going after the scam. But I think that they are going to, I think they're going to be, you know, they're going after the low hanging fruit now, and eventually they're going to have to start going after some of the higher hanging fruit. Or there's going to have to be some substantial change in the way that the law works. And, you know, I think the Ether Delta thing is really interesting, that they went after this guy for his DEX effectively like being not decentralized enough. And it raises the question, okay, so if this guy was actually like really anonymous, then what? Or if someone just publishes a contract on the blockchain, you know, like the DAO, for example, was published anonymously. Nobody knows. I mean, we have some guesses about maybe who published the DAO contract, but we don't really know who published that contract. This is gonna happen. I think you'll see a response to the SEC's action here on Ether Delta from the other DEX is gonna be further decentralization, further anonymity. And then, you know, how they're going to go after kind of the DEX 2.0, where you don't have any clue who it is. I think they're going to have to wrestle with that issue. Like, how do you enforce your rules against this thing that's completely headless and decentralized?
I also noticed we've got a common enemy potentially in the Wall Street Journal.
Oh, yeah. I'm not really a fan.
I took aim at Paul Vigner this week. I'd been following him for about 18 months and noticed a very consistent negative bias on Bitcoin articles, some quite patronizing headlines. Juxtapose, if you compare that to Nathaniel Popper, who tends to write very balanced headlines and balanced articles. I read it was just constant, like, Bitcoin still hasn't grown up. Bitcoin isn't mature yet, and whenever there's a price crash, it's the price plunge, and it's just constant negative. So I went through the archives of the Wall Street Journal for about 45 minutes, and I was just kind of ticking, right, is this negative, neutral, positive? And almost everything was negative or neutral, very little positive. But in there, I did a quick search, and there were three Ripple positive stories. And I'm not saying, I'm not gonna say there's any conspiracy, but it just seems like there's this bias to write very negative articles that attack Bitcoin. And what I hadn't realized at the time, I remember the article about Shapeshift, and I remember reading the article on the blog, but I hadn't linked that article to what I, like, my issues this week. And now I'm starting to think, God, there almost is, like, there is an editorial bias against certainly Bitcoin, but crypto as well. And I think you felt that, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, Paul Vigner used to be, I think, thought of as, one of the crypto champions of mainstream media. He's one of the earliest guys to cover crypto. He did that book with Michael Casey. So it's kind of weird to see this. You know, I don't know what's happened in his mind over the course of time, or if he was always thinking this way. And the Ripple thing is really strange, right? Like, what are this guy's holdings? You know, is he somehow incentivized by Ripple to write this stuff?
Well, I didn't want to make that link in conspiracy, but somebody else said, quite rightly, well, Bitcoin doesn't have a PR team. So it could just be as...
Yeah.
It could be that. I mean, who knows what it is, but it's just this editorial bias, which seems to be very anti-Bitcoin and anti-crypto.
Yeah, it's... I wish that... you know, I think Nathaniel Popper does a good job. I wish that there would be more kind of neutral, objective pieces, but it seems so much of media just generally has just turned into opinion and not about telling like a balanced story or presenting the facts. And I think so much of, you know, this is why when I see the CFTC saying something about market manipulation in Bitcoin, I just have to laugh at it because, you know, if you think the market manipulation comes from people like spoofing orders, you know, then it's just got to be, it's nothing compared to the manipulation that happens in the media with people posting, you know, timing the postings of their negative articles or their hit pieces or whatever, or their heavily biased piece. So I think that is really, I mean, look, we can't even protect our presidential election from manipulation through the media. So, you know, I think that is really, unfortunate, you know, that these news agencies have basically become marketing companies or, you know, or just ad salesmen. They're selling ads and everything else is just like a means to that end. And now maybe these guys are prop trading crypto on the side too. They know, okay, well, we're selling ads, but why don't we trade crypto too? Because we know every time we publish a hit piece on Bitcoin, the price drops 10 points. And so we should just short Bitcoin every time we're going to publish an article. We'll make some money doing that too.
Well, sometimes I also think there's a lack of understanding. You know, I've been no way near as long in crypto as you have, seriously, for coming up to 2 years. First dabbled about 4 years ago, but really 2 years. And I'm still learning stuff now. I mean, this, you know, every time I do an interview, I'm reading and learning. And sometimes I think, God, how can a mainstream journalist write a real in-depth piece without having spent so much time in it? The only thing they can do is phone and speak to some people, but then who do they know who to phone? So I give some of the mainstream press like a bit of a pass because they're just hit with the same stories. On the way up, they report huge price rises. On the way down, they report negative news. But someone like Paul, I'm very surprised with, because, you know, he does know a lot. He has been in the space a lot of time. He does know who to speak to.
Yeah.
And when he was writing about Bitcoin on the anniversary, you know, his quotation was from Jeff Garzik, which, you know, I've got respect for Jeff Garzik for his time in early Bitcoin, but I don't think he's a fair representation of Bitcoin after what happened with the fork.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yep. I don't know. There's so much terrible coverage of crypto. And I think, like you said, it just, to really write an informed piece, it just takes so much time. And, you know, you really have to invest a lot of time. And unfortunately, there just seems to be a surplus of people interested in covering the space that just aren't willing to put the time in or haven't put the time in. You know, maybe it's one of 10 things that they're covering. You know, and you know, like we saw with the Shapeshift thing with the Wall Street Journal, they can contact you. You can get contacted by a reporter from a mainstream respected publication. You can spend 6 months talking to them, explaining everything to them in excruciating detail. And at the end, you wind up with this crazy story that like completely misunderstands the whole thing, or just takes like that 2 minute soundbite from you. You know, out of the 6 months you've been talking to them, there was 2 minutes in there where you said something that they completely take out of context, or you know, is they find a way to make it so salacious and sensational that you know, their piece turns to be about that, because maybe the other stuff just wasn't that interesting. You know, they did some A/B testing and the piece that accurately describes the situation didn't do so well, but that piece you know, that's based on that 2 minute blip, well, that did really well.
Yeah.
So it's just like a total shame that you can't even it's hard you know, as someone who regularly talks to the media, you always have to wonder, you know, these guys are often mercenary. You know, they may come to you with an idea for one story and be getting your opinion about that. You know, like I just told you, I think it's crazy when the SEC says that, you know, spoofing is a, or the CFTC says spoofing is a problem for manipulation versus like the media. You know, they're not at all concerned about the media, even though that's like 1,000 times larger of a problem. You know, you could take that. We could be talking about market manipulation broadly, or we could be talking about anything. And I would say that. And then your headline would be, Powell thinks the CFTC is full of shit or something like that. Right. And then like, that's the whole story.
That's what basically I'm going to quote you from this article, this podcast now. we've got about half my questions, and we already had 1 hour and 10. So listen, I'm not going to take up too much more of your time. I just want to ask you one more thing. I was out in San Francisco this summer. I love the place, but it's been a few years since my last visit where I actually had some time in the city, and I was a bit blown away by the increase in homeless people and the drug issues. I read about it on Twitter. I saw the complaints, yeah, and, you know, crap on the streets, and hadn't really noticed it. But then I was there in a city with my children, and obviously, you know, just trying to keep an eye on them, it kind of blew me away a little bit. I've also seen you tweet about it, and it's been a problem for your staff, right, man? What's going on there?
Yeah. Yeah, we've actually had 3 people attacked by just like totally crazy people out of their minds. I referred to them as crack zombies in my tweet. And I think that there are some people understood crack zombies to mean homeless people, which it doesn't at all. I made no statements, no judgments about whether these people were homeless or not. But yeah, they're these people that are just completely out of their minds. You know, I think that you'll see people shooting up in broad daylight. If you walk through one of the train stations there, it'll just be littered with needles, people shitting all over the place. And they'll be marching around on the streets among people, turning over trash cans, walking into convenience stores, making a disaster in the store. You know, and it largely goes unchecked. You know, I think it's a really tough problem for the police to solve, because like, you can't just put these people in jail. You know, they really need like mental health support. And it's gotten so out of control. You know, I think it's just gone unchecked for so long that it really is just at this point where it's just everywhere. And you can't get away from it. And it feels like it's kind of taken over the city. And, you know, you have people that they don't want to come into the office because it's dangerous walking down the street just in broad daylight, because you have these people that are just totally out of their minds and unpredictable. You know, like when some guy like grabs you and tries to bite you, you know, you can't even like, what do you do about that? You know, it's just like, okay, they're like rabid dogs like wandering the streets. I'm just not going to be walking on those streets, you know, and you can't like blame the animal for biting you, you know.
No.
It's just like, it's not like a rational person, you know. It's not something you can hold accountable and say, whoa, dude, like biting me is not really, like, that's not an ethical thing to do. You know, like they thought your face was an apple, so they're trying to bite it.
Yeah, well, my friend left. She she said it'd become like Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
It really is. I mean, people's getting their cars broken into for nothing. We had another employee that he had. So, like, it's common practice just to like make sure your car is like totally empty and there's like nothing on the seats, like not even like a penny, you know, to give them any reason to break into your car. Well, this guy's car was like totally clean. Somebody broke his window, broke into it, and stole out of the glove box the car manual. Like, why? You know, so there's no safe place. I mean, there's just like the cost of dealing with all this stuff is high. So a lot of people are moving out of the city. A lot of people starting to work remotely.
I mean, there's a lot of money in the city.
The city's budget is like $11 billion a year now.
Right.
What they're spending all that money on, I don't know. it doesn't seem to be going very far.
Yeah.
There's this problem that California has, where we're not able to really raise the property taxes on people, and there's all this like really ancient like property tax like grandfathered in to families and stuff, and so like cities have to do all these crazy things, like introduce all these crazy taxes on businesses and like payroll and all this stuff to try to like make up this tax deficit that they have. So this is like another problem with San Francisco, really, is you have these sky high real estate prices, but the landlords aren't paying for it. You know, the property owners aren't paying for it. And so then it's like imposed on businesses. And now businesses are thinking, well, you know, why should we have to pay for that? We just employed, you know, all these people in your city. You ought to be giving us some kind of benefit for that, you know, not like an extra tax.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to be really hard. It's going to be hard for the city to retain people.
So if we can just finish up, can you just tell us what's coming up for Kraken? Tell people where you want them to keep an eye on what's going. You don't tweet much yourself, but
yeah.
I still think you're worth following for the odd gem you put out there. But how do you want people to keep an eye on you? Who do you want to hear from?
Yeah, definitely follow my Twitter. Follow that's Jess Powell, Kraken FX, and CryptoWatch. What's coming up for Kraken? More tokens. We plan to list a lot more tokens in the near future. New website, mobile app. We got some really cool stuff coming for CryptoWatch, which is also owned by Kraken. So keep an eye on things. Subscribe to the newsletter, follow the blog. Those are all great ways to stay updated.
Cool. Well, listen, thanks for coming on, Jess.
Hey, thanks for having me. Great talking to you.
Okay, so what did you make of that? Did you enjoy the interview as much as I did? Jesse's pretty damn cool, right? Kraken was actually one of the first exchanges I used, and I love what he's doing. I love the culture of the business he's creating. I love how he stood up to the BitLicense and New York regulations. I just think he's one of those really, really cool, genuine people. I hope you enjoy it as much as I do, and hope you go and check out Kraken. Just a note, I'm going to be in Washington and New York next week for a few interviews I've got lined up. If you're in either city and want a beer, then reach out to me. I'll tweet out where I'll be. Come along, have a beer. Looks like I've timed New York pretty badly. I think I'm going to be there on Thanksgiving. It sounds like everybody is leaving the city at that point. So if you want to come and find me and have a whiskey with me on Thanksgiving, then please just reach out. Give me a shout. And look, if you want to support the show, there's always many things you can do. And I do really, honestly, really appreciate all the support I get. Firstly, you can become a patron. Head over to patreon.com/whatbitcoindid. Well over 30 now, including Jesse. So if you want to do that, it does help support the show, and I'd be very grateful. You can become a show sponsor if you're interested in advertising on the show, reaching new audiences. My growth is getting, it's really cool. Like, I'm about to crash through 100,000 downloads for the month, which is pretty amazing. So if you want to reach out to new audiences, feel free to email me on hello@whatbitcoindid.com. We can book a time to have a chat, to talk about some ideas. You can leave me a review on iTunes. 5-star reviews really help. And also subscribe. Hit the subscribe button. Apparently that's really good for indexing on iTunes. So when people search for Bitcoin, I will come nearer the top. So you can do that. You can follow me on social media. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Medium. My handle on everything is @whatbitcoindid. You can also check out my website, which is www.whatbitcoindid.com. Lots of useful resources on there, different ways of navigating the old podcast. You can subscribe to the newsletter on the website too. I'm trying to do a daily email. It's just a digest of everything Bitcoin. Hopefully that's helpful. Hopefully if you signed up, you're enjoying that. And also you can share the show out with your friends and family. Okay, thanks for all the support. Next week I will be hitting the 1-year anniversary of the show and also my 50th episode, which is going to be a pretty special one. And yeah, just thanks for everyone who's supported the show in the last year. I've really enjoyed doing this. Looking forward to another year of it. And listen, I hope you have a great week. If you've got any questions, as ever, you can always email me. It's hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And I hope you have a great week.